You're listening to the Rural Advancement Podcast. Rural Advancement provides resources to empower, equip, and encourage rural pastors and churches. Join our community by visiting us at ruraladvancement.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rural Advancement. This is the podcast that is by rural leaders and for rural leaders. It is our goal every single week, week in and week out, to bring you content that is not just spoken to the rural church, but is spoken by people who get it. People who have lived, worked, and ministered in small, out-of-the-way places, and people who understand the immense value of the work that God does there. I'm your host, Joe Epley. And this week, I'm excited for our guest. If you listened to our last episode, I kind of included my own thoughts on the book that we're going to review today. But I have pastor and author Sam Rayner on here. He has been a pastor for 20 years. I'm excited to hear his story. I'm excited to unpack his book, The Church Revitalization Checklist. And we're going to talk more about that. But you're in for a treat today. But first, I want to say, Pastor Sam, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. We are on two different sides of the United States, but technology has brought us together.
Definitely has. And you reside in Florida currently?
I'm in Southwest Florida. That's correct.
Southwest Florida. Man, I bet it's beautiful there.
Always. But Montana, you can't beat it either. One of these days, I'm going to get up your way, and I hear that it is one of the most phenomenally beautiful places on the planet.
That is true. We, for a state of 1.1 million people, our belief trumps that by a lot. We are like, we're the best. It's just the best place to live. But hey, I'm excited to talk today about your book, about your work. Obviously, you've done a lot of writing, and we'll get to that later. But for today's conversation, we're going to be talking about revitalization. And you wrote a book on that subject about how to practically prepare for it. But obviously, small town, small church is often a place of story. And so we just want to take a couple minutes and get to hear yours. You know, maybe it starts with getting saved at a young age or going off to Bible college or just starting something. But I just love to hear the then, the now, and kind of the in-between, you know?
Well, I could fill the hour with stories, Joe, particularly of my first church. My first church was a mega church of six people. I was 24 years old. I had no idea what I was doing. And jumped right in it. So rural setting. Now, in full disclosure, I am a city boy who was called out into the rural areas. And I was
we got a lot of those. I am one of those as well. So, I mean, you're okay. In good company.
All right. So I was driving 2 hours one way just to get to my first church. I had one key leader. His name was Herbie. That's his real name because I can say that. He lives off the grid. There's no way that he will find me or I will find him anymore. So
that's wild.
Yeah. I'm sure you've got a few of those in Montana as well.
Mm-hmm.
Great guy, great church. Struggling community in rural Kentucky. I was in seminary at the time. I was working in the corporate world. And God just said, go preach. And I thought my calling was going to be to these churches that nobody wanted. I thought sure. I was going to be a corporate guy, just go out there on the weekends, kind of shepherd the few people that are there, nurse them back to health, move on to another church, kind of just do the same thing, just in the surrounding region, any church that would have me. Well, that changed over time. I didn't quite end up doing that. I'm co-vocational still, but at a larger church now and not in a rural setting, but that's where I cut my teeth. And you know, Herbie had more tattoos than teeth. He smoked Marlboros, and if I didn't finish at noon, I mean, if I did not finish at noon, he would light up those Marlboros in the back of the church. He wasn't going to miss the sermon, and he was not going to miss his smokes. So you know, it was a great opportunity for me. I joke because I think a lot of your listeners can relate to the idiosyncrasies of small rural churches.
Yeah. But
those folks were incredible people, and they ministered to their community well. They understood the heartache that often comes with rural areas, the trouble that can be there. It's a very different kind of thing than, say, in the city. People have a different way of life, and that way of life is important to them, but it includes some very dark things. I mean, there's darkness everywhere, right? So I was able to learn from them, and you know, they'd sometimes pay me in food It's just how they showed love. They're farmers. They were farmers.
Gifts in kind. It's a real thing.
It was. And I wouldn't trade it for anything. We didn't have air conditioning, which was kind of a big deal in Kentucky. It may not be so much so
I'm
in
sure it's a little
Montana, but
human, but.
more humid, yeah. But we canvassed the community. We asked for donations. We shared Jesus. And, that little church of six grew to about 40.
Nice.
And I look at, I'm not going to win any awards for that kind of growth, but as your listeners know, that's hard to do. And there are a lot of success stories out there that we just don't talk about with rural churches because, hey, it was 40 when I got here, but it's 65 now, but we're 20 or 30 years younger on average. Like nobody talks about that church, but that is a phenomenal story.
Yeah, a testament to what God's doing.
And you're winning the next generation. So I love the fact that God works through smaller churches, which most churches in America are smaller. The median church size, new data just came out. The median church size in the United States is 70 people. So most of your churches are under 100. They're somewhere between 50 and 85. That's a very normal church in the United States. We need more of those, not less.
Well, man, again, love that touch point, love that background. With that in mind, I read your book a couple weeks ago, the Revitalization Checklist, right? And I think in this particular moment in history, I have found these two streams popping up. I feel like as usual and as always, and of course as it should be, church planting gets a lot of good attention because it should. We need to be planting the church in places it's not, replanting the church in places that there once was, and all those things. But the twin stream that I have enjoyed watching kind of grow in the body of Christ is this idea of revitalization. Because I think that, number one, I think there are some real difficulties to rebuilding what's already there, building upon it, taking tradition and bringing it forward. And so your book, what I really loved about it for me, and listeners can go back to the episode where I kind of review it on my own terms, but it breaks down in such practical ways, like, hey, there is a how to get from point A to point B. It's not insurmountable. It is not a far out there lofty goal. It is not impossible. And with that in mind, I think today, I think we're just gonna kind of walk through it. As I read through it, just thumbing the pages, I was thinking of questions, and I said, "Man, hearing my take on something is what it is." But hearing the author's take is kind of fun, and hearing you expound on that,
Your
obviously.
take may be better, Joe, because I wrote it a while back. Like it was a few years ago, like 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. And I don't know, I write a lot, so I don't always remember what I wrote. So this could
That's
be
fair. This will be refreshing.
I
It'll be
don't have a
fun.
copy in front of me. So if I stumble around, then the listeners will know what's going. Like he doesn't even remember what he wrote, and we'll just have to
That's
see. So
okay.
I'm looking forward to these questions. I'm going
It's
to get a
okay if
pop quiz on my own stuff.
if this is anything like our pastors, and I said, "Hey, what was your sermon series 3 weeks ago?" They're not going to be able to tell me either, so it's fine.
It's exactly right. And I am among them as a local church pastor.
So we're just going to dive in. These are things that were points of interest to me. I think some of these attitudes referenced kind of in your book serve as a great foundation, a great posture for entering into revitalization. And I'm sure as your own journey has continued, there might be stuff to add to this. And I really do encourage listeners, we're going to give you a chance at the end to hear from Sam about, other things he's written and kind of what he's up to now in that sphere. And I just encourage you. I think this is, a good resource. And so just diving in, topic that's near and dear to my heart is optimism in leadership, right? I think for me, it is my natural temperament. So, of course, it's really easy for me to be like, yes, everyone should be an optimist. But you kind of make a pretty bold statement in your book that, like, pessimism has no place, right? To remind you of your words, you were like, pessimism has no place in church leadership, and that all leaders should be optimists, right? And so, why the strong language? Why is optimism so critical? Again, in this context of revitalization, throw it at us,
So let's define terms, because if you define optimism, realism, and pessimism differently than me, well, then you can make a different conclusion. So optimism is the idea that there is something better, and I'm going to get there. Realism is properly diagnosing, like okay, I have a good understanding of what's really going on. pessimism assumes the worst. So if you are always assuming the worst of your people, you're always assuming the worst of your church, you're always assuming the worst of what can happen in the kingdom of God, you're not leading. So a realist will have a worst case scenario. A realist will plan for those things.
Sure.
But a pessimist, really, it really becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's a form of what some have called the poverty gospel. You know, there's the prosperity gospel. There's a flip side of that. There's the poverty gospel where, oh, woe is me. I'm such a wretch. I can't do anything. God would never use me. How awful is all of this? Well, that doesn't take anyone anywhere. So I do make the strong point in the book that in order to lead anywhere, but especially in the kingdom of God, you've got to be an optimist. I have to assume that God is going to work. When I share Jesus with somebody, my assumption is that they will accept Jesus, not that they won't. Why would I share Jesus with someone pessimistically, thinking there's no possible way they're ever going to receive Christ?
Sure.
I'm going to share Christ with them, knowing the power of the Holy Spirit, and say, that person might just get saved in this moment, and I'm going to assume that God will do it. Now, if he doesn't, I got to be a realist. I got to say, okay, it didn't happen. Great. Maybe next time.
Yeah.
If you are a church leader, you should remain an eternal optimist. Why? Because Jesus wins. That's where the optimism comes from. Jesus wins. He doesn't lose. He wins. So let's be optimistic about it.
Man, I love that. And again, I like that it's not just personality grounded, pragmatically grounded. It is truly theology grounded, where you say, hey, we're bringing it right back to Christ. Like, I was looking at a theologian the other day, and they talk about the long defeat of Christianity, and yet that's their point. It's just this counterexample of, like, it is a long defeat because it's not a loss. Like, it's long because Christianity marches on through everything in history that should have stopped it, you know? And obviously bring that to our small town church and we go, man, we have a reason to hope. So, man, I love that. Kind of continuing off that theme, a little adjacent, but obviously one of the biggest hallmarks in revitalizing a church, one of the biggest things that really in any church that, that people are concerned about or looking at, is this idea of attendance, you know? I think there's been a lot of good scholarship in the last, you know, couple decades about why numbers are a great metric for some things, not always for others, how we can measure success in so many different ways. But I still think attendance is tough. And I do think sometimes an attitude that can creep in to pastoral ministry is there can be an overfixation on numbers. You know, there can be that total loss of hope because, man, attendance is dropping. But there can also be a very subtle and maybe self-protecting complacency, kind of an is-what-it-is type approach, you know? And so when you look at the life of a church, when attendance starts to drop, what is that broader impact on a congregation? And what exactly is kind of the pushback that we should have? You know, how do we stem the tide of, like, man, the attendance is dropping, dropping, dropping. Like, what do we do with that? How do we neither, you know, gosh, flame out on it, but how do we also engage fully in it, you know?
That's a great question. And I think it's something that every pastor feels, right? So let's take that church of 50 people. That's a pretty standard rural church. Some are a little smaller, some a little bigger. We got 50 people. We've got some folks that have been here their whole lives. The 80-year-old that, like, knows nothing other than this church.
Yeah.
She's not going anywhere no matter what, but she doesn't have many years left. So let's say that church of 50 drops to 40, you know, drop of 20%. Well, that's something to take note of. Like, of course, like, that is an issue. That's, you got to be a realist. But then you flip it around and say, well, we've got 40 people to get out there now, and they can all go out there and they can work in the kingdom of God. And every one of them should be able to win somebody to Christ over the next year, 2 or 3 years, whatever it is. So there's no reason to believe why we can't grow from 40 to 60 to 80. Now, again, that's not going to win any Outreach Magazine awards. You're not going to get on any lists of the largest congregations, but you have people to work with. Now, you might say, well, of that 40, only 10 are going to work with me. You've got 10. Great. So, of course, we track the attendance. Butts in the seats are important. I mean, like, if
Yeah.
nobody shows up to
Yeah.
listen to the proclamation of the word of God,
Yeah, then we're missing something.
there's something wrong. But can we be over-fixated? Yeah, of course we can. Can we lead our churches with just attendance in mind and nothing else? Yeah, there's a lot of churches that have done that, and to their detriment. So when you are a rural church, a smaller church, a church that may not have all of the programming bells and whistles, the facility bells and whistles, what happens is you really strip back to the things that matter. And you can truly focus on those things. So let's look at this from an optimistic perspective. I don't have a lot of the ancillary garbage that comes with being, a 100,000 square foot campus. I can just really be laser focused on the really important things in my community. I can help solve the problems in my community. I may not grow to 2,000 in attendance because, well, there's only 1,500 people in the county, wherever that may be. But I can do the kingdom of God. I can do work in the kingdom of God really well. So I would say this about attendance: track it. It's an important metric. Don't ignore the warning signs. But it's not the thing alone that determines success. I'll tell you a story. I was consulting a church. Make sure I get these numbers right because I don't have them in front of me. But they had declined by 8 people on average over 40 years. So that's 320 people. So they had been 500. Make sure I do my math right in my head. They had been 500 and now they're 180. I think I have that right. So this is a church of 180, which is a larger church,
Still,
like particular.
in some ways, you're like, wow, if you didn't know the story, you'd still be like, what a healthy congregation.
Yeah, and it didn't have a big facility. It was in a small town, not rural, but small town. And they had lost some people to the mega church down the road. It really wasn't a mega church, but they thought it was. The larger church down the road. And most of them were young families. And there are all sorts of reasons why that happened. Not important for this point. I met with the elders actually, and that they were complaining about everything. And I said, "Well, okay, just give me your data." They gave me the data. I charted it out. I just put it on a graph of the last 40 years. And they looked at me and said, "Well, that's not real. Those aren't real numbers." I was like, "They're the numbers you gave me. I
They're
didn't
like,
make
this is
these
made up. And
up."
you're like, wait a second.
So there were eight elders. They'd been there for that long. They'd been there for all of them, most of those 40 years. These are elderly men at this point. And I looked at them and I said, if you eight had just done your job as elders and gone out there and each of you won one person to Christ each year and assimilated that person into the church, you wouldn't have declined, regardless of how many people left. Just the eight elders could have solved that problem. Eight people per year on average over the course of 40 years, 320 people total. And here's the thing, you don't feel eight people when you're 500. You don't feel eight people when you're 400. You don't feel eight people when you're 300 or even sometimes 200. But it does get to the point eventually, decade after decade, where you go, something might be wrong. Well, the main thing is the main thing. And churches need to stay focused on the work of evangelism and discipleship. And if they do that, they will be just fine. They may not grow as rapidly as the big blowing and going church down the road that's getting a bunch of transfer growth from everybody else, but you will survive and you will eventually thrive. Well, this church made some changes. They started doing some ministries that other churches were not doing, and they started growing again. And they got it, and they fixed the problem. And they went from a woe is us mentality, I guess we're just doomed to decline, to maybe we can actually do some things here in this community that other churches aren't doing. And they turned it around. I believe that of every church. Now, there are cases of churches where it's a rural setting, there's a big factory, closes shop.
There's a what do you call it? Kind of an apocalyptic event in a town where it's like,
Yeah,
man, something
that does
happened, the water turned
natural
bad,
disaster,
a business shut down, all the things.
tornado, fire, hurricane wipes everybody out. Those things do happen, and those are very painful
Yeah, it's a
stories.
different kind of story for sure.
Different kind of thing, Most, and here's the thing, in those cases, other churches need to step up and help
Right.
and rebuild the community. That's where everyone else from the surrounding regions in the state and everyone else
Yeah,
just come.
absolutely.
Hurricane Katrina hits New Orleans. All right, we're all
Yeah,
in.
we got to take
Let's
care of it. Yeah.
rebuild. Aside from the cataclysmic event, whether it be natural disaster, the only corp employee an employer in the community leaving, aside from that, I do believe that if churches stay focused on evangelism, discipleship, and really go for it,
Yeah.
that they can turn it around. It's not
Yeah.
easy, but let's be optimistic about it.
Yeah. I love that. Small loss can be offset by small gains. Like, it's not that small loss has to be offset by huge gains. Like, that's the, because I think the task, the loss felt easy, but the growth back feels insurmountable. But truly, like you said, it's very practical, you
So
know?
let's just think about death rates. Death rates are roughly 1 to 100 in the United States. It's not exact, just
Sure,
so
sure.
people. So if you have a church of 100, and you're of average age, like your
Yeah.
median age is like 40, you're going to
Yeah.
lose about one person per year to death. Now, if your median age is 60 or 70,
Right, you're gonna
it's
lose
going to be a
two,
little
three to
higher.
four, yeah.
Yeah, you'll probably lose 3 or 4, if you just do the math. So let's take this church of 100. And let's say you are committed to winning the next generation. And let's just say you know you're going to lose 2 or 3 to death each year. So you're at 100. And if you don't do any, and let's assume that there's not a lot of transfer growth, you found a way to retain your people.
Yeah.
And you know that naturally you're going to lose about 3 or 4 people per year. And then you've got another 10% that move. The mobility rates in the United States are about 10%. So let's just say you know if you do nothing, you're going to lose roughly in a rural community, 5 to 10% of your congregation each year. Now you can go from 100 to 90 to 80 to 72 to 65. I mean,
Yeah,
if
exactly.
the smaller you get, the less these numbers apply because you got like three people. Well, it's a different,
Yeah, it's
the math doesn't
33%
work.
loss, yeah.
You don't lose 0.3 of a person. But at 100, you're likely going to feel some of this. So it's really just as simple as you're a church leader and you go, okay, realistically, we're a church of 100. You're looking at your roster, the people that come regularly. We might lose 3 to 5 of these people per year,
Yeah.
just realistically. All right, so what's your goal? I'm going to get out there and see if I can win two families over to get them to
Yeah.
come to church. And families, 2 and 3 and 4 people at a time. But it's
That's
just two or
huge.
three families a year. Now, maybe you're plateaued. Maybe you're like, wow, we've kind of stayed right around 100, but you keep winning the next
Yeah.
generation. You
It's cutting
keep.
against loss and gaining. Yeah.
Sometimes the plateau is success. That's the point that I'm making.
Yeah.
We were an older church. We really weren't going anywhere, but we really are reaching new people. They're coming into the church. We are losing some people to death or being homebound. They just can't come as much.
Yeah.
So, but it is a success. I see it all the time where these pastors are like, man, I've been here 5 years. We've grown from 65 to 70. It's nothing
Yeah,
to
and it's
shout
like,
about.
and you're like, no, you're not only not losing, but you're gaining. This is great, you know?
Yeah, but you've won families. It's like I look at
Yeah.
the church and I'm like, actually, you've done a really good job here.
Yeah.
So we have to change the metric of success, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
We have gained, back to this attendance conversation. We have gauged success by the lagging measure, like the actual growth rate.
Oh,
When
sure.
success needs to be, how many people are you inviting? How many people are you sharing your faith with? Is everyone sharing their faith every week? That's the lead measure. We need to stop measuring the lag and counting that. Well, we need to keep measuring the lag. We need to stop counting the lag measure as success, growth rates, number of people here. And instead, focus on the lead measures, the way that all that happens. So what I do in my church is I celebrate the fact that somebody was invited, whether they come or not. I
Nice.
celebrate the fact that somebody shared their faith, whether or not somebody did come to Christ. Why? Because they're being obedient. What we can focus on and what we are called to do as Christians is the lead measure. God handles the lag measure. So stop determining success by what God's work is and start determining success by what your work is.
That's a good line. That's a good line. Okay, shifting gears a little bit. Another very common thing in the rural church you mentioned in the book, of course. We're in the midst of trying to say, hey, how do we move to the future? And the pesky past keeps popping up, right? You kind of have this idea of like, you're coming in usually full of ideas or at least desperate enough to try things. And the congregation might be with you a little, but But there's kind of this undercurrent of, I mean, I had in my small town church, I had deacons who'd been there 80 years, and then their parents had planted the church, and there was just a lot of history. They'd seen pastors like me come and go by the dozen. And so there's a good place, I think, for history, nostalgia, this kind of idea. But you mentioned that you can't necessarily like lead from that place, but it factors in. And so how does a pastor, especially when they're trying to bring new life, new momentum, new way forward, how are they going to properly place and leverage the history of the church?
So there's good things in history, there's bad things in history, right?
Sure.
That's the case of any church, any era, any location, anything.
Yeah.
So you want to leverage the things of the past that are good, right? So let's
That's
start
it's a
there.
good starting statement. Yeah.
Yeah,
Cut out the
let's.
stuff. Do not reproduce everything.
Yeah, not everything needs to be reproduced. So the question then becomes like, how entrenched is this church, and what do they really want to hang on to? So in my church, the people, when I got to West Bradenton here in Florida, they were totally fine with a complete overhaul of the bylaws, which is crazy to think about because a lot of
Yeah,
churches
that's
hang on
kind of wild.
they hang on to the bylaws like it's God's word. But when we started, so I was able to do a lot of governance changes early on that most wouldn't be able to do. But then when we were renovating the sanctuary, I had no idea people cared about these ugly these ugly chandeliers that were like from the 90s, and they were not meant to last. They were not well made, but apparently they were a thing. So I had more of a battle with stinking brass chandeliers
Of all things.
than I did the bylaws, okay? So you just pick your battles. Like if you're in a small rural church and you're like, wow, they are really hung up over this thing, whatever it is. Well, you know what? Is this thing going to get in the way of gospel work? No, I can work around it. But work around it. Like, you've got to pick your battles. You've got to gauge what you can survive and what you can't. This is the realist, not the pessimist, but the
I like
realist.
that though. Gauge
It's
what you can survive,
just
man.
there. You know that if, like, well, if I change this, they're going to fire me. Don't change it. If you want to keep, like, if you, seriously, like,
Sure. That's so
doctrinal
funny because,
issues.
but we do though. We attack these things because, because they treat it as so big, you're tempted to just like lock in on that as like, well, that's the thing I got to change. And it's like, well, no, the river can run around the rock. Like it just goes,
Yeah, great analogy. It becomes a litmus test of power in the church and who's going to really have it. Like, stay away from those battles. Don't fight them. Yeah, if you're dealing with an entrenched congregation where granddad planted the church and you're new, you ain't going to win that battle. So focus on the things that you can change. Is it heresy? Is it anti-gospel? That's worth not only losing your job over. That's worth losing your life over, right? So there are certain things that are like the exclusivity of Christ. I'm not compromising on that. The authority of God's word. I'm not
For sure.
compromising on that. What kind of chandeliers we have in the sanctuary?
Could care less.
I care because they're ugly. But I'm not like it, we ended up working it out, by the way. We don't have them anymore, but because we showed pictures of the old sanctuary, like the way it was originally built, and didn't have chandeliers because these things were from the 90s. And everyone was like, oh, it looks so good. And I'm like, I know, doesn't it?
That's
So we
such a, but
ended.
that's what we talk about, right? Like you found history that was way back in the day that was acceptable, but it was still different from what they had experienced. And you were like, hey, here it is.
Well, because the people that were fighting, and they weren't really fighting. I'm
I
probably
know, but they were
making this,
passionate. They were passionate though.
I'm probably making it a bigger thing for the radio than it
Sure,
really
sure.
was, but they were passionate about it. But they grew up in the 90s. Like they came of age. They were having their kids and in the 90s. So but then I took people even further back in our history and they're like, wow, this looks good. And I'm like, well, let's do this. And it ended up working out. So I used history to my advantage there. The point that I'm making though is if it came down to my job or chandeliers, guess what? I ain't fighting over chandeliers. I'm just not. So if you're a pastor and you're listening to this, like do what you can while you can. You may not be there your whole life. So do what you can while you can. Leave the church in better shape than when you got it. That way, the next person has a little better church. So there are going to be cases of these rural churches where they're going to have five pastors in 20 years. They just are. I mean, that's just reality. Well, in that series of five pastors, if you all have this, if you all have the same attitude of we're just going to leave it a little better than when we found it, well, slowly that church is going to get better.
I love it.
So yeah, just pick your battles, and if it's history where you're like, I really just think that this is terrible, but it's not a gospel issue. Live to see another day, man.
I like that. And I think it gives us a good way out because, again, I think that sometimes, it becomes a identity moment of like, well, am I the kind of person who can tackle, or am I the kind of person who can lead? And it's like, well, no, this is not. You don't have to prove anything. Just like let God's work do its thing, and again, like you said, focus on what you can change.
When I stand before the Lord, Jesus Christ, he is not going to look at me and go, good and faithful servant, you got rid of those chandeliers.
Yeah,
Good
that's true.
work on that one.
You can come in, special spot, hanging out with Peter. You did it. Hey, let's talk about other things that are difficult to change. People, generally, turns out.
Yes.
So, but again, there's something that happens, especially, let's say, on that front end of a pastoral journey. You might come into a church in the first couple of years. You might have this competition, and nobody really verbalizes it out loud, but the competition is between the people that you wish the church was and the people the church people actually are. And I think that, again, if I asked any pastor point blank, nobody's going to own up to this, not even myself. If I said like, hey, do you want to love the people in your church for who they are? Everyone would be like, well, of course I do. But the reality is that there's this kind of frustration that creeps in, this kind of, man, I wish they would just figure it out, that they would get going, that they would latch on to the idea, that they would see that what we're doing is for growth. And it can start to create this second congregation in our head where we go, man, in a perfect world, and we start comparing the frustrating people of today with the people they wish they were tomorrow. And I think it takes people out eventually. I really do. I think like if that tension builds too much, someone goes, man, this church doesn't want to change, and I'm done. And so how do we love people as is? Like whether it goes somewhere or not, maybe speak to that a little bit, but like how do you truly say, man, in the moment, I'm just going to be with these people, frustrating or weird as they are,
I always push back when I hear someone say, I would never pastor a church where I couldn't be a thriving member. And I'm like, there's a whole slew of churches that are never going to have pastors then. Like, this idea that you have to walk into ready-made success because the church is already healthy. It's like, well, maybe God is calling you there because it is really, really messy and they need some help, okay? So you have to love the people where they are. You have to. They're the people you're inheriting. They're the people that are already there. Like, well, they're a bunch of jacked up, malcontents. Well, God called you there. You're gonna have to deal with it.
They're actually specifically your jacked up malcontents. That's the
So I could tell you horror stories that are that I would like I don't want to relive about people that were really challenging to work with. Let me put it that way. In churches where I was young and naive and thought I had all the answers, and we all just butted heads. So your posture must be, and here's the thing, people will feel it. No one would ever like you're pretty you would be a pretty mean person to just say, I don't love these people where they are. Like n
Of course.
nobody really says that out loud. But people feel that. They feel it. And the best thing that you can do as a new pastor, or even now, if you haven't done this, is just enjoy your people. Fly fishing's a big thing where you are. Go fly fishing. I got boat captains in my church. You probably don't have too many boat captains in your church.
I almost chimed in earlier and I wanted to facetiously say, what's a hurricane? We've never really
Oh,
experienced
I could tell. I mean, well, okay, so that's a great bonding experience,
that.
let me tell you. It's
Great
hard to
bonding
argue with
experience.
someone who has a chainsaw in their hand standing next to you.
Yeah, that's
You
true.
don't get in an argument when you're chainsawing,
But
which
you
we do to
mentioned,
the...
yeah, boat captains, deep sea fishing, I'm sure, all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah, we're right up against the coast, so we have all of that. My point is, guess what? I'm out on the boat with them.
Yeah.
Golfing. I don't golf, but I'll try.
Yeah.
Baseball. Baseball's really big here. All right, cool. Oh, your kids play soccer. So do mine. All right, let me get on the
Yeah.
soccer field with you. So you, it's like, well, how do I love these people where they are? Be where they are.
Yeah.
Just go hang out with them. Literally,
Yeah.
ask the expert guide who's a fly fisher. Hey, can you take me out on one of your days where you don't have anybody? Like, and just
Yeah.
would you, and then learn
And of course,
something.
they're gonna love it. Like, they're gonna love it because they're like,
Yes.
man, this person who enriches my soul, theoretically, if that's how it's working. And it's like, man, you're my pastor. And it's like, well, now you get to show genuine interest. You know, I was just talking to somebody the other day, and I found out they had a marketing company. And truth be told, marketing's cool, but like, was never my thing. It doesn't matter. Like, it's not an interest of mine. It's not something I'm like aware of on a day-to-day basis. But I was like, you know what's really fun when someone who's like got a passion for something gets to talk about it? And so you just ask the best questions of just like, man, tell me about that. What's the biggest deal? What's the craziest client you work with? This is, you know, what's that been like for you? What are the trends right now? Like, you know, and it doesn't matter if I truly like deep down would have asked that by itself, but it's like, man, they walked away feeling valued and heard, and I learned something and we had a good time.
You cannot shepherd people unless you know them.
Yeah.
And you have to know what makes them tick. And once you learn what makes them tick and you're genuinely loving them where they are, then you can lead them. You have to have a mentality of serve first, lead second. And far too many people come into a church and try to lead first and serve second. So if you have a posture of, I just want to know your world. Now, some people will be glad to invite you in. Others will be more arm's length. They may or may not
Sure.
trust you. You know what? You are not entitled to people's trust.
Boom, say it again. That's crazy.
You are entitled to respect if you're a
Sure,
pastor.
sure.
You are, there is a level of respect that must be shown to people in
Sure.
leadership.
To
Bible's
make
very
this
clear about
whole
that.
thing work. Yeah.
But you are not entitled to their trust. If you lead people as if you are entitled to their trust, they're going to push back on that because you have to earn it. You have
Yeah.
to earn it. It's like dating somebody, first date, and you just assume that they're madly in love with you and that they want to marry you. That person's a psychopath, typically. So,
Yeah,
you know, like
we tell teenagers, we're like, run. You know, like I'm a youth
you
pastor.
don't
I'm like,
want that.
hey, that's not it. Okay, like whatever that is, that's not it.
Date one, hour one, I just got to know you and I'm madly in love and I want to marry you. It's like, yeah, that might be a problem. Maybe it works out by the grace of God, but you know, typically those are warning signs. So, same thing in the church, man. They're not gonna trust you up front. Even if they know you, the fact that you're now in the leadership position is like,
Yeah,
what are they
that's
gonna do
true.
with this?
Changes the dynamic.
Yeah, even if you're promoted from within, even if you grew up in the church, doesn't matter. You're in a new role now. So earn the trust. If you earn the trust, if you're interested in the lives of the people, if you shepherd them where they are, if you just hang out with them where they are, that will build over time to where you'll be able to lead the people in the direction that they want to go. And you may say, well, that could take 10 years. Yeah. Yeah, it could. It could. That's reality. Maybe five, maybe two, but I doubt you win everybody over in 2 years.
Sure.
But you might be able to get enough momentum in 2 or 3 years to like really start doing stuff. Gets back to the berry bucket principle.
Okay.
So this is an old principle. It is not mine. It goes back to like church growth movement, 1970s stuff. So
Okay.
this is an old principle. The old berries are, it's not age, it's anybody that was there before you got there.
Oh, interesting.
The
Sure.
new berries are anyone that came after your first Sunday. So, you know, first Sunday, who's here? Those are your old berries. The next Sunday, maybe you say, oh, we got a new pastor. Let's go see. And then they stay. Those are the new berries. So when you're in a church and you get to the point to where the old berries are now the same weight, the same amount as the new
Sure.
berries, is typically when you experience tension in the church. Because all of the new berries are there because they came in believing in your vision. They
Yeah.
are likely at the church, unless they came because of family reasons. You know, they are there because they believe in what you're doing. The old berries, well, they came in under a different set of assumptions and different leadership. Or survived old leadership, whatever it is, they aren't there because of you. You were there because of them. So you've got to, when you get to that point to where they're equal weight, that tends to be a point of tension. That's when most pastors don't survive because they don't manage that well. They have enough support from the new berries.
Sure.
And they pit the new berries against the old berries. But guess what?
Which is easy to do, of course, because you're trying to say, oh, we've got this group of people that can kind of convince folks, like we can finally, or vote. Yeah, we can do the 50-50 thing. And it's like, we got 51, they got 49. You know?
That's exactly right. And typically you don't survive that. So you, the point at which you have to manage things the most with people, back to the idea of people, is when new berries and old berries are roughly the same amount. Mm. That's when people tend to be at each other the most, and they don't even know why. The old berries just kind of feel things slipping away. The new berries feel the momentum of like, wow, we've got a lot of new people. This is great. And you have to make sure this is the time when you go back and you invest in the old berries and you make sure that's the extra trip out to grandma to just visit with her, the matriarch. That's the extra. You know, hey, let's sit together at the ball game while we're watching our kids. You okay, man? You know, I'm here for you. That's when you really need to be investing a little more in the old berries while not neglecting the new berries. And typically you can survive it if the old berries feel your love and they know that they can trust you.
Mm. Wow. Man, this is all good stuff. I if we go by one-liners, I mean, we're like five deep here that are just going to live with me for a bit. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's really solid, Sam. Thank you. Next one, and I really love this. It was kind of a small section of your book where you're just talking about, you know, hey, you're getting into this church, trying to bring new life, new growth. And you mentioned something, again, my general personality leans this way, but this idea of like, how does humor work in a struggling church? Because obviously, when a pastor is communicating, whether that's in meetings or obviously in sermons from the pulpit, there is this like reality that struggle is heavy. I mean, you might be walking into a church where the people, I mean, they're not like unaware that their church is in trouble. You know, if there's 15 of them left and there used to be 50, they're not usually blind to like the feeling of where they're at. And I think there's a fine line because you can't condescend, you can't poke fun at things that shouldn't be poked fun at, but you do kind of have to be able to, I don't know, introduce a lightheartedness. And so I just loved your take on it. So I wanted to hear it in your own words. How do we kind of, you know, how do we lean into that appropriately, you know?
Two words for you.
Okay.
Buena salsa.
Buena salsa. All right.
Buena salsa. Now, let me tell you the story.
I'm excited.
So we have 45% of our community around the church is ethnic. Almost all of them Spanish-speaking background. So Central and South America.
Sure.
So our whole goal is to reach our neighborhood. If we reach our neighborhood, we're going to look like the neighborhood.
Sure.
We should be approximately half,
right,
you know, Spanish-speaking background and half Caucasian, and 10% Black as well. So we're working our way there. We haven't arrived, but we're just reaching our community.
Just trying to be realistic to match the people you're reaching.
Perfect. It'll happen naturally over time. Like we're on a good track here. Well, what that means is we have Spanish speakers in our church, and that we teach ESL, English as a second language, that we help them learn the language. Like that's important, but not everyone can get it right away, particularly if you're older. Learning a language is hard. So we do our best to have translators where necessary, particularly with some of the older generations. And I was so that means our deacons meetings sometimes need a translator. Our staff meetings need a translator. At times in a worship service, we do some combined worship services. It's great. It's a lot of fun. But it does come with tension, back to that point of like, just that natural tension in the church. So I was in a meeting and we had a Southerner in our church. We tend to be a more Midwestern culture here in Southwest Florida. The further south you go in Florida, the further north you get, just so you know, that's kind of a...
I have a friend of mine from Jacksonville who's a youth pastor in our kids pastor in state. And he says that a lot, though. He's like, the further north you go, the further south you get. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So, we're in the southern part of the state. So we tend to be a more northern sort of culture. But we do have some southerners here. And there was a southerner in one meeting and she was getting frustrated. And there's a saying in the south, and I don't know if it's up your way, but it's definitely a saying in the south of good gravy. Like when you're frustrated.
Sure.
Like good gravy.
I'm at least aware of that from a trope standpoint. Yeah.
Okay. So she said it quite emphatically and paused. And so the translator is looking at me like, I'm not, exactly sure what she just said because it's an idiom. Like, it doesn't
Yeah, it
translate.
doesn't
It
translate
doesn't.
literally, yeah.
So I just nodded and I was like, go ahead, translate it. And the translator goes, Buena salsa.
Which is just good sauce in Spanish, basically.
It's good. Yeah, good
Good
sauce. It's
sauce,
good
I
sauce.
guess.
So now, anytime I get frustrated around our Spanish speakers, in a moment of levity, in a moment of humor, I just go, Buena salsa, everybody. Buena salsa. And they
Buena
laugh.
salsa.
So, one way that I can reduce tension is through humor. That's the point that I'm
Yeah.
making. Find those moments that capture the laughter and use them to reduce the tension and go back to that well as many times as you can. I can't tell how many times I've told Jesus, our Spanish-speaking pastor, well, he'll get frustrated at something, and I'll be like, dude, just buena salsa it. Just
Buena
buena
salsa.
salsa. You have to laugh together, and if you're laughing together, it's hard to be angry at each other.
Yeah, that's huge. I really like that. As we kind of see the end of our conversation here, just two more questions. One of them, you were kind of playing off in this book, the one of these church growth principles that came out. There's the term that came out for a while that was just rolling around of this big, hairy, audacious goal, like a BHAG goal, And obviously the challenge was, what's the scariest, basically what's the Christian scariest thing you can think of for your church, and then just try to do that, And I mean, I'm simplifying a little bit, but you kind of mentioned this alternative that fit better with the church and revitalization. We've touched on it a little bit when we've talked about, we're not going to reach 20 families, we're going to reach two, and like, what does that look like? But you used the word MHAG, or the acronym MHAG, for middle, holy, audacious goal. This idea of middle being realistic, holy being man mission, but again, even that can be confusing. And so unpack that, and really just tell us, like, what does it look like to do realistic goal setting if your church is smaller, struggling, you're trying to gauge momentum? Like, grab that for us,
So, middle holy audacious goal is derived from Jim Collins' work in the secular world
That's what it was.
with the
Yes.
BHAG. It's in the it's either in Built to Last or
Or good
Good
to
to Great.
grade, yeah,
I
some, yeah,
forget which one of
for
those books.
sure.
I think it's Good to Great. Regardless, credit where credit is due, I want to cite my source.
Absolutely.
So I got the idea from the secular world. But then I thought, secular principles don't always relate one to one to the church, right? So we have to be careful
Yeah.
about that. You can't just throw in a business principle in the church and expect it to work. You have to do something that is holy. So,
Contextualization, we call
yeah,
it,
middle, holy,
yeah.
audacious goal. The idea is very simple. You underestimate what you can accomplish over time, and you tend to overestimate what, how quickly you can move. So,
Sure. Yeah, I can confirm with that for
yeah,
sure.
you overestimate what you can do in a year, and you underestimate what you can do in five is kind of another way
Nice.
to say it. So the middle holy audacious goal is based on this idea of like do one thing every 6 months, like set a goal, like middle. So it's 6 months, it's a year, it's 9 months, give or take a
Yeah.
few months here. Like this isn't like a 3 year plan. This is
Yeah.
just I've got one thing I want to do over the next 6 months, and I'm just going to work through it. Holy, it's something that honors God. Audacious, it's more than what you typically do. Like this is beyond all of the normal stuff and goal. Like it's actually got some
It's practical. It's it's an
measurable things here.
achievable thing. Yeah.
SMART goals, and people probably have heard of that. It's something that you can measure. So what you do is, and this is, I still do MHACs to this day at my church. Like every 6 months, I'm like, okay, what's a project? It
Yeah.
could be a renovation, it could be a new church management software system, it could be an outreach program. And we're going to implement it. And some of them stick forever and some of them don't. Some of them are
Sure.
one-time things and some of them are ongoing things. We want to start a marriage ministry. That's our MHAG for the latter part of this year.
Nice.
We've got children's ministry. We've got student ministry. We actually need a marriage ministry now. So we've got a partner. We're going to do that. We're going to implement the marriage ministry program. But that's a, and we hope it's ongoing. But that's an MHAG. Like so we're going to focus on this one thing. We're not going to do anything else while we're doing the renovation because everyone's all hands on deck for the next. It's we're right in that. That's the one we're in right now.
Yeah.
Once that's done, on to marriage ministry. And you may say, well, you can do five and six things all at once. Like, yeah, if you want, but it's a bit of a fire drill. I'd
Yeah.
much rather. I plan on being. I'm not really being called anywhere else, I don't think. I mean,
Sure.
I guess things could change this afternoon, but I don't plan on going anywhere. So I'm 46 years old. I've got a few years left in me. Let's just chip away at this every 6 months. We're just working on stuff. So this is for the leader who has a long-term vision. This is not I'm an interim pastor for 6 months, and
Sure.
this church is about to fold. And if I don't
Yeah.
do something bold, it's going
Yeah,
to be
obviously there are
bad.
limits. You're like, hey, medical, like EMT is for emergencies. Like, hey, like we are, if
This
it's
is
an emergency, you have
the
to set these rules that are
non-emergency
crazy.
strategy.
Right.
Yeah, the non-emergency strategy is what we're talking about. You're there, you've got a long-term vision, you don't plan on going anywhere. Every 6 months, every 9 months, whatever it is, you can have a 3 month in a MHAG. But the idea is it's middle. It's not long term, it's not short term, it's not a couple of weeks, it's not a year or two. It's kind of in that monthly sort of range. And just chip away at stuff. And it is amazing what you can accomplish. Like after 5 years, you've done 10 in MHAGs. Now let's say eight of them were successful, or seven of them were successful.
Yeah, you're still making real
Now
growth.
you've implemented seven strategies in your church that worked. And all that you did was like, it's just one thing every 6 months.
That's really cool. And
That's
again, I
the
hope
principle of the
that,
MHAG in the book. Now, in the book, we describe how to do it, and there's a lot of
no, of
detail
course, of
around
course. And this
implementing
is meant to
things.
be a bit of a sneak peek. And I do want people to go check out your books. I mean, it's good stuff, you know. And there's not much. There's not. We can't cover everything in an hour long. But I will say, kind of wrapping it up with what I felt like was a good heartbeat. Because again, let's say a pastor's tuning in and they're saying, "Hey, I want to learn all about revitalization. I'm in the middle of the struggle, or I'm about to enter the struggle." And you mentioned this kind of quote at the end of your book or near the end of your book. The church's biggest problem is not a lack of giving, a lack of people, or a lack of leadership. You've already lost some people there because they're like, listen, all I have is lack of people and lack of giving. But the church's biggest problem is the lack of assurance in the pursuit of God's glory. So tell us where to fix our eyes in this revitalization process, Sam.
Yeah, at the end of the day, when you stand before God, you're not gonna, you're not standing back before your congregation, right? You're standing before the holy creator God, and you will be judged according to whether or not you were obedient to his will. So you have to stay focused on that. Have fun, love your people, enjoy the quirks and the foibles and the silliness. And somebody's upset because this room got painted blue instead of green. Okay.
Yeah, we painted a metal cross on the front of our church 3 different times in a
There you
year.
go.
It was
There you
absurd. I
go.
was like, what are we doing?
So, all right. People are people, but you are ultimately, in the scheme of eternity, not going to be held accountable to their perceptions of you. You're going to be held accountable to your obedience to God. So this is where, of course, we're strategic, we're practical, we do what we can, and if we can't, I mean, we don't dwell on it, but don't lose sight of the fact that everything you do has to be for the glory of God. And if it is outside the will of God, don't do it. And if it's inside the will of God, give it everything you got.
Well, those are great words. I would hope that people would leave this kind of conversation encouraged. But Sam, I just want to say thank you so much for being on today.
Always a pleasure. I'll be glad to come back, go skiing up your way, and visit
Yeah,
the
Montana's got some good
incredible and
stuff.
great state of Montana.
Before we go, I do want to give people an opportunity to connect with you. And so I know that you have written obviously more books since this one. Maybe give us a snapshot. What's the latest project that came out, or what are you most excited about, or where can we find stuff about the stuff you're writing? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so you can go to samrainer.com. That's one place, or
Which we will have in the
churchanswers.com.
show notes. We got both those. We'll get them.
And one of the things that I'm excited, I've got several projects that I'm working on, but I'm really excited about our Church Equip curriculum line.
Ooh, cool.
So it's for adults, $15 a month for everybody in the church.
Nice.
So like
That
if
feels
you're a small church,
affordable.
yeah, if you're a small church, it's like, wait, $15 per person. No, 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 no.
No, per month.
$15
Love
per
it.
month for everybody. And we've got a whole system there. We're rolling out new studies every month. We've already got a good library that's there. We are the low-cost provider on adult curriculum. There are others. If you want to pay a whole lot more, you
Sure.
can get more. You can get more. But for those who are like, you know what, this is just all we can afford, we decided to come into that space, and we're doing our very best to. So don't ask for a discount, because it's already like as low as I can
This is
possibly
not,
go.
this is not like a podcast deal where you're like, put in this for 10% off.
No,
You're like,
I
listen, this is
can't go any
$15, people.
$15 a month. Yeah. So it's called Church Equip. You can go to churchequip.com or churchanswers.com and find it there. But that's the one thing I'm really excited about.
Well, good. Well, we will have those links in the show notes. Again, love when we can return to a well. Love your ministry, your heart for the small town church. But again, for this week, I hope that you walk away from this conversation encouraged, empowered, equipped. Please be confident, rural pastor, that God sees not only what you're doing, but where you're at while you're doing it. He is with you, dealing with all the quirky people and all the isolated places. As usual, you can always find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, ruraladvancement.com. But true to the rural form, the best way to spread these conversations is just to find another rural leader and say, hey, there's a set of conversations, a resource, some things that I want you to check out, pass it on. But for this week, he has been pastor and author Sam Rayner. I have been your host, Joe Epley, and we will see you next time.